They're regal and strong, and they make life on Earth possible. On today's edition of Please Explain, we're going to talk about trees. And joining us now are Jessica Arcate, the forest manager at the New York Botanical Garden, where she manages the garden's historic 50-acre native forest, and David Allen Sibley, a world-famous bird guide, author, and illustrator. He has now turned his attention to trees, and he is the author of the Sibley Guide to Trees, which has been described as an astonishingly elegant guide to a complex subject, the trees of North America. Pleased to welcome them both to our show. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
And David, welcome back. Can we begin by defining what a tree is? Is it a plant? Is it would it be pretty much just a variant on any kind of a plant with green leaves?
Basically, it is, yeah. A tree is just a plant that grows really big and has there are trees, species of plants that grow into trees come from all different families. And in the same families, even in the same genus, there can be other species that are just little ground-hugging plants. So there's a formal definition of a tree that's fairly involved, but the one I like best that I mentioned in the book is if you can walk around it, if it's a tree. If you have to walk, or if you can walk under it, it's a tree. If you have to walk around it, it's a shrub.
But there are other differences. Trees have trunks. They have bark. They often have a lot of wood in them. Jessica, you're nodding your head.
Yeah.
That is different from the plants that I have growing out on my deck.
Yes, definitely. The definition I think I like is that trees are perennial vascular plants, and they are shedding, and they are able to form wood, which is completely physiologically different than any other perennial that we would grow in our garden. And shedding in the sense that, yes, they shed their bark, and they establish wood and develop wood. They have a trunk that can be very tall or, you know, not so tall, but one single stem coming up from the ground.
And do they function the same as other plants? The way they gather light and make food for themselves?
Yes, more or less. They all photosynthesize. It's all very similar. In trees, they have two main structures that make them slightly different in that their xylem and phloem, which is their vascular system that other vascular plants do have, but the xylem grows on every year and it stays there, and that's how we get our annual rings.
Now, it's one of the few things I remember from my college biology class. The xylem is where the water goes,
yep.
And the phloem is where the nutrients go.
Right.
I had to remember that for a test, and I don't know, that stuck, and everything else has gone.
Well, that's wonderful.
David, when we're identifying trees, how are they categorized? Are there certain distinguishing features that are used to differentiate different species? And is species the right word?
All living things are classified into a hierarchy, and the species is the smallest unit. There are subspecies also, but generally the smallest unit of classification is the species. So there are species of trees, and those are grouped into genera and families and orders and other higher levels. And basically, taxonomists try to get at sort of the family tree, the evolutionary relationship, so tracing the ancestry of different species through millions of years. To see where they shared a common ancestor.
Have we found a common ancestor, or is this a kind of parallel evolution from different kinds of plants?
As you go back through time, you might only have to go back a relatively short geological time period to find a common ancestor for, say, two species of birches that are just barely diverged. You'd go back farther to find where birches and alders diverged, and farther to where birches and oaks diverged, and even farther back you'll find where birches and palms diverged. I don't know, maybe Jessica knows if there's a if it's thought that there's a one common ancestor somewhere way back in the eons for all plants.
Would that have been when there was just one continent before they drifted apart? Do you know, Jessica?
What I remember is that plants in the lycopod family, they may have been the first to form sort of tree structures, and it was during that era where all of our carbon has come from. Once all those trees became extinct and formed that layer, that's where we get our coal and a lot of our oil from. But other than that, that's all I remember.
And now, of course, trees give us our oxygen.
Right.
They take the carbon or carbon dioxide, and we get oxygen out of it.
Yep.
Is that all trees doing that?
Yes. All trees and plants photosynthesize and do that.
Do they all have root structures that serve similar functions?
They have root structures that take up water, which is actually really important in urban areas. They help manage stormwater as well. So the main things that trees really need are air, soil for their roots, nutrients or minerals, and, of course, light. And the trees photosynthesize. They take in our CO2 or carbon dioxide. They produce oxygen. And mainly their respiring happens down in the root area or the use of oxygen.
David, when they were evolving, did similar trees evolve in different continents? Or are American trees uniquely American, European trees uniquely European? I realize that we've moved trees from all over the world. Palms don't grow naturally in California, I don't think. We get London trees here on New York streets. But did they evolve uniquely in different places?
Yeah, certainly there are some. Well, I guess the answer is yes, yes and no. There are some really distinctive sort of evolutionary radiations of trees that happened in different places. So there are oaks all around the Northern Hemisphere, but a whole group of oaks that are uniquely North American, that are all related closely to each other and distinct from the European and Asian oaks, and there are also examples of I think some of the classic examples of convergent evolution, where species that aren't related but growing in similar conditions in different parts of the world will converge on the same form. What we see on trees is all determined by efficiency, by the needs of their photosynthesis, responding to the climate. They're not evolving to develop a certain appearance the way birds do to attract a mate or defend a territory. The trees are just evolving in response to their environment. So if they're two species in the same environment in different parts of the world, they'll tend to converge on the same, or they can converge on the same solution to solving the challenge of living in that environment.
My guests are David Allen Sibley, author of The Sibley Guide to Trees, and Jessica Arcate, the forest manager at the New York Botanical Gardens. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a little while, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org during the segment about trees on Please Explain. We were talking about different solutions to problems. This is the time of year when we start thinking about trees changing color, or at least the leaves changing color. And some do it more than others, and then there are evergreens that don't change color at all. These are all different solutions to different problems, or the same problems, because an evergreen can thrive right next to an oak tree, can't it, Jessica?
Yes. Deciduous trees, they go dormant, and they don't put as much investment or as much energy into building their leaves every year as evergreens do, because they only last one season. Evergreens tend to produce their needles or their leaves that can hang on for a couple of years. So it's an investment that each different type of plant decided to do or evolved to do. And it's dependent, as David was saying, on evolution, you know, how these plants respond to their particular climates.
But we're most likely to see an evergreen in a colder climate.
Yes.
And a palm tree would die in a colder climate.
Right.
And why is that?
Well, evergreens, again, their leaves are very thick. They have put a lot of investment on a sort of an outside cuticle that protects the leaf itself. Palm trees don't have that. But you know, there are plenty of deciduous trees that also grow in very cold climates. And I guess if a palm is deciduous too, they do lose their leaves. So it's not, I don't know, in the true sense, an evergreen that I think of. An evergreen I think of are spruces and pines and firs, conifers, or cherry laurels, or southern magnolias. Those are the types of evergreens I think of.
David, the tallest trees in the world are the redwoods in California, aren't they? Do we understand why they grow so tall?
I'm not sure if there's a... I was going to add to that last question that the needles of evergreens are... They do eventually fall off the tree. We just don't notice it as much because they keep their needles for 2 years, 3 years, some up to even 25 years, and then they'll fall, but they'll still have lots of green needles left, keeping the tree evergreen. But if you live under a eastern white pine, you'll know that for a few weeks of the year, there's a lot of dead light brown needles falling.
And if you cut them and kill them and make them into a Christmas tree, I guarantee the needles will fall off when you're carrying them into your house, and even more when you're carrying them back out.
That's right.
Well, but let's talk about redwoods, because they are tall, and I've always wondered how nutrients get up to the tops when we're talking about trees that can grow to nearly 400 feet tall. That's a lot of phloem and a lot of xylem, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. They are amazing trees. Actually, Hyperion is the tallest tree in the world. It was documented in 2006. It's 379.1 feet tall.
And where is Hyperion?
Hyperion is in Humboldt County, California, so the northern coast of California, in the Redwood National Forest.
And is it a redwood?
It is a coastal redwood, so it's Sequoia sempervirens.
Are they also the oldest living things on Earth?
No, they're not. Actually, bristlecone pines are, Pinus aristata, and they're native to sort of the White Mountains of California, the mountains out west.
But it's in both cases the oldest and the tallest are in California?
Yeah, and also the biggest in volume. Our giant redwood, General Sherman, is the biggest in volume.
But then we have those really wide trees in Africa, the baobabs.
Right, so I guess the argument is the single non-clonal organism. Whereas I think there are also aspen groves in Utah that are considered pretty big, too.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention that the aspen groves in Utah, well, there's one in Utah that's been studied, but all over the West, a single root system will survive for thousands or tens of thousands of years and keep sending up many individual trunks. Each trunk only lives maybe 100 years or 150 years. And we call each trunk a tree, but it's coming from a single root system. And there's one that's been studied in Utah that's estimated to be 80,000 years old or more. But it's still a single organism. It's just that what we see above ground looks like a whole grove of trees, but they're all related underground.
And are they? Do they continue to grow? Is that how they stay alive? Or do they, for me, I reached my ultimate height when I was in my teens, and if anything, I'm going to shrink a bit somewhere down the line.
Mm-hmm. Trees continue to grow through their entire life, most trees will reach a maximum height, and then as they get older, the trunk gets thicker and the branches spread out more, but they continue to grow.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking listener calls and also going over some of the things that people have written in on our show page. My guests are David Allen Sibley, who is the author of The Sibley Guide to Trees, and Jessica Arcate, the forest manager at the New York Botanical Garden, where she manages the garden's historic 50-acre native forest. Stay with us. Trees are the topic of today's Please Explain. We're talking with Jessica Arcate of New York Botanical Garden and David Allen Sibley, author of The Sibley Guide to Trees, which follows all of his books on birds. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's go to John from Paramus, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Leonard? You asked us a great question. That's what I was going to ask. Why are the redwoods, the sequoias, so big, and why do they only grow in California? Is it the climate?
I would definitely say it's the climate. The forest in which they grow, they have access to so much moisture, and the temperatures are ideal. Out here in the Northeast, we don't necessarily have that long extended season that they have, and the temperatures are perfect for those plants to continue their just physiological processes.
But what about the soil?
The soil.
That must be a factor.
Absolutely. The number one factor that has to do with tree height is the soil depth or the soil volume. The soils are much deeper.
How deep would the roots go for a tree that is growing to 300 feet tall?
Well, the diagrams that we've sort of come up with has been everything you see above ground happens below. Mm-hmm. And
there's an equal amount, really? It's going that wide and that deep? Well, these trees are near each other, so they can't.
Or if they
the
don't
roots
go
can't
as,
go too wide.
If they don't go, well, if they don't go, yes, they can. They can spread out and they compete and they find their little nooks and crannies throughout the forest floor. But if they don't go down as deep, they definitely spread out, and they can cover more surface area.
But that's the only place in the world that has these conditions?
Well, it's the only place where those trees grow anyway. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody could start one somewhere else, but you'd have to wait thousands of years to see if it was a success or not, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Has anybody tried to transplant a redwood?
Well, we do actually have a giant redwood at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx as part of our conifer arboretum, and that's actually a giant redwood. It's not the coastal redwood. And we will see. It was planted in the 80s, our specimen, and the coastal redwoods will not grow here in New York.
David, this sounds like a question for you. A listener left it on our show page. He says, or she says, I read somewhere that oak trees are the best for enhancing biodiversity, that a multitude of insects prefer to live in oaks, and this in turn attracts birds. Is that true, and does it hold true across the country?
That is true. It brings up the topic of invasive or exotic species. When something like a Norway maple or a ginkgo tree is planted here, it's been taken out of its natural environment where it evolved for millions of years with insects and other animals, and it's put down here in the United States, where it doesn't have any native insect pests. So that's good from a landscape point of view. Your tree in your yard is not going to be attacked by a lot of insects, but as far as the birds and other animals are concerned, a tree without insects is not providing a lot of food. So oaks are right at the top of the list of hosting the highest diversity of insects and really big numbers of different species of moths and lots of other insects that the birds love to eat.
What about ailanthus trees? Joe in New Jersey says, in my backyard there's a giant ailanthus that started as a weed more than 40 years ago and grew like Jack's beanstalk. Mm-hmm. If records are kept for high ailanthus trees, what's the highest? Are they are there uses for the wood? This is a weed tree, isn't it, Jessica?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It was brought in and has spread around cities. The one great thing I like to talk about is that ailanthus is susceptible to a wilt called verticillium wilt. Actually, maples are susceptible to the same thing. So there is somewhat of a control now. It's not one of the hot invasive species anymore because it is being controlled.
So something finally got
something
to it.
Something finally did, yes. And there's definitely still plenty of ailanthus trees, and I do have a couple in our forest, which we are trying to manage and get on top of. But
you didn't plant them; they just came by themselves.
They came in, yes. But as for trying to figure out what the biggest ailanthus is, I would recommend checking the National Register of Big Trees. I'm sure that there was one documented. We have a pretty big male in our collection.
You call it a male?
Yeah, they're.
Do trees have? Are there males and females?
Yes, there can be, depending on the species. It's called being dioecious, or having two houses. So a female plant has only female flowers, and a male plant only has male flowers.
And can you spot that right away?
This time of year, yeah, because if they're bearing fruit, which the ailanthus trees, they have samara, or winged fruit, that's a female.
Well, so that's the same. That's why we call them females, because they bear fruit.
Right.
Andrea from Kew Gardens, Queens. Hi.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. I'm having a argument with someone where I live. We have big, great old-growth trees, and there's crowding issues. And she said that at this point, the trees are really not producing oxygen benefits anymore because of their age. That at one point they stop and they end up putting out more carbon dioxide than oxygen. Is that true?
I've never heard that. I guess you'd have to document their rate of photosynthesis, which is when they're using their carbon dioxide.
But does it change during a day? Don't they produce more oxygen at certain times during a day? And
at night.
Carbon dioxide.
Well, they produce more oxygen during the day because light is available, and that's what they use. That's their energy source to produce their sugars that they need, and then they release their oxygen. And they respire almost throughout the day, but I guess they respire more at night when they're not photosynthesizing, if you look at the cost benefit. Trees, they do, with great age, they do slow down. They don't grow as much. You can see dieback in the tips of their branches. Maybe in looking at, but I would my guess would be is that they don't respire as much either. They're not growing as much. They don't need as much energy. So I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know the full answer to your question.
Thank you.
It would have to be as long as they have green leaves.
Yeah.
They must be undergoing photosynthesis, which would produce oxygen.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your call. And we go now to Greg from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air. Greg?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was wondering also about old growth trees. I had heard that there weren't any in the Northeast or the New York area because they've been cut down. Everything was cut for agriculture, but I know of one in the Bronx, and I... seen some really old trees around northern Manhattan, and wondering if there's any one species that's particularly good to become old growth, and if there's any concentrations of them around our area.
Well, the term old growth, and actually, yes, the one in the Bronx is the forest that I manage at the New York Botanical Garden. It's 50 acres of old growth forest.
Okay.
The definition of old growth forests are that it's a forest or a plot of land that has trees growing of great age, greater, 250 years or greater, living among trees of varying ages. So this tells us that it wasn't clear cut at one point and then allowed to regrow. And then throughout history, disturbance, windstorms or whatnot have caused, the younger trees to come up and regeneration to happen. Now there's varying levels of forest development, and more mature forests or old growth forests tend to have oak trees or hickories. We also have lots of tulip trees and sweet gums and maples in our forest. So when you talk about old growth, you don't always talk about, you know, a specific species. You talk more of an ecosystem and a community. And there are more and more, they're discovering these plots and these areas of old growth forests throughout the Northeast that did, you know, the reason our property was not clear cut was it's really dramatic topography. We have shallow bedrock. We have ridges. No farmer ever really wanted to go there. So we lucked out.
And I'm assuming there are also old growth trees in Prospect Park and in some of the parks in Staten Island, maybe Forest Park as well, where the parks were established a long, long time ago.
And Inwood up in Manhattan as well.
Okay, a listener wants to know whether aspen roots survive forest fires better than other trees. David, do you know?
I think they do, since they're underground, and that's the most trees, if the part that's above ground is killed or burned, then that's the end of the tree. But aspens, since the real the living part of the tree is underground and it's constantly sending up new trunks, they can survive a fire pretty well. So yes, I think that's true.
Another listener says, we can walk around a dogwood. It has other characteristics you've mentioned as defining a tree, and yet it's North Carolina state flower. So what gives?
Trees bloom. And to me, I think some of the prettiest flowers come from trees when you think of cherry blossoms or magnolias.
So the flower that comes from the tree is what the state is really.
Right.
Okay, we go now to Alan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Park Slope on 3rd Street between 8th Avenue and Prospect Park West, right near the park. Between Prospect Park West and 7th Avenue, there are three American elms, one of which is right next to my house. One at the top of the block, right across from the park, had a sudden dieback about 2 years ago and was cut down. One down at 7th Avenue the following year had a sudden dieback and is now gone also. These were, you know, major American elms that were over 200 years old. And I'm wondering about the house, the tree that's next to my house, what to do about it. It's on, the city says it owns the property that it sits on, but they don't seem to work on it.
Well, if to protect American elms from Dutch elm disease, which is a fungal disease that clogs the vascular system of elms, and it was devastating throughout American cities because elms, just like in front of your home, draped our streets. They're gorgeous when you see them in Central Park. But what we do at the Botanical Garden, and we have some magnificent elms as well, is we do a preventative systemic treatment where you can put in a fungicide, which the tree, you inject it into the tree and they can take it up, and it's a preventative treatment so that the plant itself can sort of fend off what the fungus will do if it does infect the tree.
And another listener wondered whether efforts are being made to preserve historic trees. That is a concern, isn't it? I guess it's different if it's a street tree than if it's a tree in a forest.
Right. Street trees are definitely more difficult.
Another listener, Judith in Park Slope, wants to know if bamboo is a weed or a tree because her neighbor has a yard full of it and it's invading her yard and she can't stop it.
Oh, bamboo. Bamboo is definitely a weed, especially running bamboo.
Well, pandas obviously love that bamboo. I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. Jessica Arcate is manager of the New York Botanical Garden's 50-acre native forest. David Allen Sibley's book has more than 4,100 exquisitely detailed paintings of over 600 tree species. And they've been talking with us today on Please Explain, talking about trees. By the way, David Allen Sibley's book is called The Sibley Guide to Trees. You also want to check out some of his books on birds. Thank you to both of you for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, we'll start off discussing international diplomacy with looks at the G20 summit and the UN General Assembly. And then Laurie Moore on A Gate at the Stairs, her first novel in 15 years. Also, Isabella Rossellini discusses her hit web series, DVD, and book, all called Green Porno. Plus, Ken Burns on his new documentary series about what has been called America's best idea, our national parks. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Ida Sadakiani and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.